Today is Tuesday, June 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
I personally have to shoulder much of the responsibility.
That's Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam. Also ahead, tensions in the Middle East continue to escalate as the U.S. plans to deploy more troops to the region. It's all on today's International Edition. There are impending changes in the Trump administration, with the president's chief spokesperson, Sarah Sanders, departing by the end of this month. VOA's White House bureau chief, Steve Herman, has been speaking with Sanders' predecessor as press secretary, Sean Spicer, about what could happen next. Steve is joining us live by phone, and thank you so much for joining us, Steve.
My pleasure.
Well, Steve, what advice is former press secretary Sean Spicer giving the Trump administration?
Well, he does have some advice both for the administration and whoever will become the third press secretary in the Trump administration. First of all, I asked him if the daily briefings in the Brady Room should return. He said absolutely, and that there's a utility in making sure people see the government in action. He said it would be an opportunity for the White House to make sure it gets its message out, and it's the best way to do that. As far as his advice to whoever succeeds Sarah Sanders, he says that person needs to be very well prepared, very up to the minute, double, triple, in quadruple, check everything that you're going to say and do because it's going to go through that level of scrutiny, Spicer advises.
Well, presidents do seem to go through several press secretaries during their administration. So what is... so hard about the job, or why is it such a tough job?
Well, I would say this job may be tougher than being president of the United States. You take all the heat when things go wrong. You don't get the credit when things go right. As Spicer outlines in his book, and as we've heard from previous press secretaries, your day is beginning by 7 o'clock in the morning, and you're probably not getting home until 10, 11 at night, and that can go on 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. It takes about, according to Spicer, 3 to 5 hours to prepare for every briefing. And he says, you have to understand that when you see that briefing, that's about 3 or 4 or 5% of the job of press secretary.
Also, I know you talked about what would happen next. So what do you think is the next step?
Well, Sarah Sanders is leaving by the end of the month. Will we have a successor named by then? Not necessarily. President Trump has not really showed his hand on who his favorites might be. There are a number of internal candidates. He could bring in somebody from outside, and somebody may take that title who's here right now, such as Hogan Gidley, the principal deputy press secretary, as acting, and then just be sort of auditioning for the job, as we've seen the president do with even some of the top cabinet secretaries.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. That's VOA's White House Bureau Chief, Steve Herman. Well, former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, the country's first democratically elected head of state, who was later ousted from power, was buried today after his dramatic collapse and death inside a Cairo courthouse yesterday. A member of Morsi's defense team said family members attended funeral prayers in the mosque of Cairo's Torah prison, followed by burial at a cemetery in the Egyptian capital's eastern district of Nasser City. Morsi's son, Ahmed, said security agencies refused to allow Morsi to be buried at the family cemetery in his hometown in Sharqiya province, and instead had him interred at a Cairo cemetery dedicated to prominent Islamists. Officials said the 67-year-old Morsi had just addressed the court during his trial on espionage charges when he collapsed. They said Morsi spoke for 5 minutes from the glass cage he was kept in during the trial and a few minutes later fell to the ground. State television said Morsi was taken to the hospital but was dead on arrival from an apparent heart attack. Among the top stories in the world, EU officials are warning the October 31st Brexit deadline will likely have to be extended. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has assured reporters she is fine after a public appearance today in which she was visibly shaking and unwell. And the 10th suspect in the shooting of former Boston Red Sox baseball player David Ortiz is given a one-year preventative sentence amid ongoing investigations into the incident. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers who have been reviewing observation data from the Kepler spacecraft have occasionally been treated to pyrotechnic displays they call superflares. These superflares are incredibly powerful bursts of high-energy radiation that are being blasted from relatively young and active stars. Scientists say superflares are hundreds to thousands of times more powerful than the largest recorded flares from our own sun. A team of astronomers say they have found evidence that suggests stars as old as our 4.6 billion-year-old sun can produce superflares once every few thousand years. They said if the sun should produce a superflare, Earth would be bathed in a blast of high-energy radiation. This could disrupt various electronic devices around the world, cause widespread power blackouts, and take orbiting communication satellites out of commission. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, tensions in the Middle East continue to escalate as the U.S. plans to deploy more troops to the region and Iran warns it would exceed uranium stockpile limits imposed by a 2015 nuclear deal. Iran announced yesterday it would cease complying with the global agreement that prevents it from making nuclear weapons, while the U.S. announced the deployment of about 1,000 additional troops to the region for defensive purposes. For the latest developments, we have live on the phone a VOA Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb. Hello, Carla.
Hi. Yes, it's been a very busy week over here at the Pentagon.
Yes, it has. So what is the latest now on this?
So we are learning that about 1,000 troops are going to be going to the Middle East. They've got expedited routing, I've been told by a defense official, to help with force protection and defense of the forces. Primarily, they're going to be focusing on missile defense and reconnaissance aircraft. That will be both manned and unmanned aircraft, I'm hearing. And I asked the defense officials I was speaking to why this is so important and why send more. And he said, well, we've got to keep an eye on Iran. And I go, yeah, well, that's kind of important, but aren't you protecting your forces? And he goes, well, we think that keeping an eye on Iran is a way of defending our forces because the Iranians are likely trying things that go under the radar. So by keeping an eye on Iran, that in itself is being a deterrent.
Also, this is coming a day after the Pentagon released the photos alleging to show Iran's Revolutionary Guards removing an unexploded limpet mine from a Japanese-owned tanker. So, you know, some people are disputing this evidence.
Well, it seems more and more that the international community is warming up to the evidence. We just heard from German Chancellor Angela Merkel that there is strong evidence, she says, that Iran was behind these tanker attacks. So the main players that we're trying to focus on is Germany, Britain, and France. They were the big leaders of this Iranian nuclear deal. And we've heard now from Britain and Germany that they seem to support U.S. efforts in protecting that waterway and in their assumption and their blaming of the Iranian forces.
Also, with Iran denying any involvement in the attacks, what is going to happen with this denial?
Well, the United States just keeps putting that to the side, and they say that the Iranians have denied things in the past that they've been directly responsible for. There have been calls for the potential of war, and the United States, many people have been saying, no, the United States does not want war. President Donald Trump just told somebody yesterday that he considers the attack a minor attack that would not cause a war, but he did say that if the Iranians break their nuclear deal and develop nuclear weapons, that would be a potentially different story.
Also, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has arrived at U.S. Central Command. So what is going on with that?
We expect him to be speaking momentarily. He has been speaking with some of the top generals, General McKenzie, who is in charge of U.S. forces in the Middle East, trying to find out Does he have everything he needs? What exactly is he seeing, and how diplomatically can he help with the situation? Because this is not just a military fight by any means. This is a diplomatic situation. The Pentagon has stressed that from day one. They want to make sure that this is resolved peacefully. And so at the same time, they have to be prepared in the event that diplomacy fails. So that's why Pompeo is there today.
Also, with the U.S. military officials saying that Iran is feeling the pressure, do you think they are going to come to the table to negotiate?
It's unclear at this point. Iran is in a really bad situation. They have reached out to the international community. They've, in their eyes, they have abided by this nuclear deal. The United States said that they were not complying enough and that it was a bad deal. And so here the Iranians sit. If they break the deal, it appears that the international community isn't going to support them. But if they stay with the deal, based on this recent attack, it's unclear if the international community is going to support them either. So it will be interesting to see what they do in the coming days.
Okay, great. Thanks for this update on this development. That was VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Well, Hong Kong's pro-Beijing leader, Carrie Lam.
Thank you. Sorry, Mike.
Offered an apology today for the political crisis and unrest sparked by a proposed law that would allow extraditions to mainland China. But she did not give in to protesters' demands that she leave office over her handling of the controversial bill. Lam told reporters that work on the bill was over until it expires in July next year, but she also pledged to stay and finish the remainder of her term. Opposition to the bill has driven repeated mass protests in Hong Kong this month. Organizers said 2 million people turned out on Sunday. Associated Press reporter Charles De La Desma has more.
In a speech, Carrie Lam said she didn't expect to be able to win public support for the bill, seen by many in Hong Kong as a further weakening of the former colony's legal autonomy at a time when communist-ruled China is growing increasingly authoritarian. But the chief executive did not formally retract the legislation, which would allow some suspects to face trial in mainland Chinese courts. She also says she hopes to finish her term, shrugging off calls for her resignation with repeated requests for another chance. I'm Charles De La Desma.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, across the United States are numerous African diaspora associations. Many strive to preserve their culture or have advocacy goals. The role of the African diaspora in the United States.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Emerson T. Brooking, defense analyst and resident fellow at the Digital Forensic Research Lab at the Atlantic Council, discusses his timely new book, Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media, with host Carol Castiel and VOA assistant producer Mitch Biter. The book explores the collision of war, politics, and social media. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, Chinese President Xi Jinping travels to North Korea to meet leader Kim Jong-un this week, looking to strengthen their sometimes shaky bond at a time when both are locked in disputes with the United States over trade and over nuclear weapons, and ahead of an expected meeting between the leaders later this month at the G20 summit in Japan. Observers say Xi's meeting with Kim could be seen as a way for the Chinese leader to send President Trump a subtle message that Washington must bend on trade if it wants China to use its leverage as a regional power broker with North Korea. However, experts are divided over how much influence China has over North Korea, which often continues high-profile nuclear and missile tests in recent years, despite Beijing's objections. Well, what happens if President Donald Trump carries out his threat to impose tariffs on the remaining $300 billion on Chinese goods that he hasn't already hit with 25% import taxes? Well, a New Hampshire fireworks company says it would have to raise prices, likely lose business, and force some small towns to cancel their 4th of July fireworks displays. A Minnesota motorcycle maker warns that it would lose business to foreign rivals vehicles that don't have to pay taxes on Chinese parts. Associated Press reporter Tim McGuire has more on the effects of the tariffs.
U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer is to testify to both the Senate and House on the continued trade war with China as U.S. companies and business groups grow increasingly concerned about the president's threatened tariffs on another $300 billion in Chinese goods. The administration is using the levies as a way to force China and its government-related businesses to stop forcing U.S. firms to hand over technology as part of doing business or simply stealing it. U.S. companies that import Chinese goods say the additional tariffs will hurt their bottom lines and result in higher consumer prices in this country. Tim McGuire, Washington.
Well, President Donald Trump will officially launch his reelection campaign today in the key battleground state of Florida. Trump is hoping voters will reward him at the polls next year for the strong U.S. economy. But heading into the 2020 race, various polls show that Trump remains unpopular with a large swath of voters, often a danger sign for an incumbent president. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
Air Force One lands for a recent campaign rally in Pennsylvania, a key battleground state in the 2020 election that President Trump narrowly won in 2016. Trump sees the strong U.S. economy as his number one advantage heading into next year's campaign.
Politics is a crazy world, but when you have the best employment numbers in history, when you have the best unemployment numbers in history, when you have the best economy probably that we've ever had, I don't know, how the hell do you lose this election, right?
A new TV ad by the Trump campaign, released on the eve of his re-election kickoff, reminds voters of his accomplishment.
And we will make America great again. Thank you.
Trump officially launches his re-election bid Tuesday in Florida and appears eager to take on whomever emerges from a crowded field of Democratic presidential contenders.
Vice President Joe Biden.
At the moment, former Vice President Joe Biden is the Democratic frontrunner with a sharp focus on criticizing Trump.
He's a threat, in my view, a threat to our core values. 4 years of Donald Trump will be viewed as an aberration in American history. Eight years will fundamentally change who we are as a nation and how we're viewed around the world.
Recent national and state polls have given Biden and several other Democrats an advantage in theoretical head-to-head matchups with the president. Trump also dismissed his own internal polling that showed him trailing Biden and some of the other Democrats in key states, often by wide margins. Presidential polls this early can be unreliable, according to ABC News contributor Matt Dow.
As we saw in 2016's polls, and the race can change suddenly, I think the president would be behooved to admit reality and to say he's behind and he hasn't been reaching out enough. But Democrats would also be, it's important for Democrats to understand polls can change suddenly, polls can change, and they don't often indicate where the American public is.
Despite the strong economy, Trump's approval rating is weak by historical standards, and it has remained consistently low for most of his presidency, says Larry Sabato.
If we simply restrict ourselves to public polls, then you could really say nothing's changed. Donald Trump has been in the upper 30s, low to mid 40s in virtually every survey during his entire presidency.
The polling suggests that while Trump has largely kept his political base happy, he will need to find a way to broaden his support if he wants to bolster his chances for 2020. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Jim. Well, Australian military chiefs are warning of the threat from increasingly sophisticated cyber attacks. They say that while the dangers do not need a traditional military response, Australia must find new ways to combat them. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Propaganda isn't new, but the way it's delivered by technology is changing rapidly. Senior Australian Defence Force officers believe their nation is increasingly exposed to cyber attacks and misinformation. They've echoed concerns raised in the United States about the use of computer attacks and the manipulation of social and mass media during Russia's efforts to seize Crimea from Ukraine in 2014. General Angus Campbell is the chief of the Australian Defence Force.
In a world that's becoming more connected, these activities range from information campaigns, cyber operations and theft of intellectual property, to coercion and propaganda that subvert, erode and undermine, breaking international rules and norms, but ones that, in the eyes of the targeted state, fall short of requiring a war response.
China is suspected of orchestrating a surge of cyber attacks on Australian businesses. In December, Australia said its companies were among the global victims of an extensive campaign of cyber espionage attacks backed by the Chinese government. The confirmation came after the US Justice Department charged two Chinese nationals, alleging they carried out hacking on behalf of Beijing's Ministry of State Security. It was the first time Australia had explicitly blamed China for cyber crime. Earlier this year, computers at Federal Parliament in Canberra were hacked in what officials believed was the work of a foreign government. A recent report suggested that Australia needed to train 18,000 additional computer experts by 2026 to fight the cybersecurity wars. But there was a warning that at the present rate, the country was likely to fall short. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Well, physical disability is quickly ceasing to be an obstacle on the path to professional sports. Thanks to advanced equipment and technical progress, more and more men and women are able to dedicate their lives to sport. Genia Dulow met with a U.S. veteran who, after losing his leg to cancer, became part of the U.S. Paralympic fencing team.
Mario Rodriguez took up fencing as a way to stay busy and positive after his amputation put him in a wheelchair. And what started as a hobby turned into a second professional career. His coach, Michael DeSaro, says he's an unusual athlete.
I think the same thing is most challenging for most people in chairs is getting over the initial fear of being in the chair, being afraid to fall out of the chair. You know, a lot of the guys that I work with, guys and girls, they're not like Mario. He's what we call an A, where he's able-bodied, except for he's missing a leg. But everything else is pretty strong. A lot of the people that we work with are B's and C's, which means they're actually stuck in a wheelchair, and that's their only way of mobility.
What Rodriguez especially liked about fencing was that it didn't require just physical strength. Stamina, quick thinking, and strategic planning were attributes Rodriguez never lacked. Unlike in the traditional sport, wheelchair fencers are always at a fixed distance from each other, and the attacks are limited to forward lunges. For the U.S. Air Force veteran, none of that was a problem, and soon he became part of the team representing the USA at the Paralympics. At a number of international competitions, opponents from the field became his opponents on a mat.
Years later, and I would fence people that were maybe a former Soviet military, and then we could fence and do fencing, and it's like, you know, he would get a touch on me, I'd get a touch on him, he would win, I would win. But afterward, we could pat each other on the back, shake hands, and have a beer together. And that was so much better than the before when, you know, we were enemies.
Rodriguez, who was a Russian translator in the military, has made many new friends. And he's found a new passion, coaching other talented fencers who share his love for the sport. Genia Dulo for VOA News, Los Angeles.
And you've been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet. And on a sad note, this is also Patrice's last day with the Voice of America. However, we all wish her the best in her new position. It's our loss, but someone else's gain. And I will personally miss Patrice. We have become good friends over the years, and we'll keep in touch. So, Patrice, I'll say, see you later. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.